This week on Making Contact.
Only 19% of all the parliamentarians of the world are female.
Saudi Arabia's decision to allow women to vote has been hailed as a major step forward. Very few nations still allow such overt discrimination. But there are still fewer than 20 female heads of state around the world. And even when women rise to the top, challenges remain.
Today, when people ask me, do I face more discrimination as being the first Chinese American mayor of a major American city, being a woman is tougher.
On this edition, a former president, a Supreme Court justice, and other women leaders reflect on the battles they've won and just how far there is still to go. I'm Kyungjin Lee, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
They did not give us the vote. We had to fight for the vote.
Sandy Threlfall is speaking to a crowd of more than 200 people on a sunny Sunday morning in Oakland, California. She's chair of the Oakland Suffrage Committee, and this event marks 100 years since women won the right to vote in the state of California.
We doubled the number of voters in the U.S. when California women got the vote.
That was in 1911. It was another 9 years until the 19th Amendment was ratified and all women in the United States were permitted to vote.
Women still do not vote in the numbers that we represent via population. And if we did vote in the same numbers that we are in the population, things would be different.
California Congresswoman Nancy Skinner was one of several elected officials at the event who stressed the importance of having women's voices heard, both at the ballot box and on Capitol Hill.
And sadly, the attack, I don't know if I want to call it attack, but the implication on women today because of the lack of women's representation is very subtle. So when we look at, say, the budget cuts, and we look, there's cuts to adult day health care, cuts to child care, cuts to education, cuts to other senior services. They disproportionately affect women. They affect women because we are still the caretaker, whether it's for children or our seniors. It affects women because we live longer. It affects women because the workforce that is represented in care for children, care for seniors, and in education is still dominantly women. So it's not talked about, but these things very, very definitely disproportionately affect women.
The commemoration of women's suffrage was both a celebration and a reminder for women to dig in their heels, especially young women. Dozens of local Girl Scouts were among those who marched through the neighborhood, including troop leader Yvonne Nunn.
It's a reminder for our young people and for elders as well of the accomplishments that we've made and the work that we still have left to do. That it takes organizing, perseverance, and that specific goal in mind to get things accomplished.
The changes in our lifetime could be considered remarkable. And for some, the obstacles faced by many of our elders in the mid-20th century are almost hard to believe.
If a woman worked, it was a sign that her husband couldn't make it. It was a disgrace for a man to have a woman who worked outside the home.
In 1993, Ruth Bader Ginsburg became the second woman appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Her rise to the top came after decades of overcoming barriers, as well as years working as an advocate for equal rights. Ginsburg founded the Women's Rights Project at the ACLU in 1972 and argued some landmark cases which brought down legal discrimination against women. In September 2011, Justice Ginsburg visited the University of California at Hastings Law School in San Francisco, where she held a public conversation moderated by Professor Joan C. Williams. One of the first questions asked was about Ginsburg's work advocating for women's rights. What gave her the confidence, back in the early 1970s, to think that she could change such a long ingrained bias in society?
The Times, the court is a reactive institution. It's never in the forefront for social change. There's always a movement in society that's pushing the court that way. By 1970, the women's movement was revived, not just in the United States, but all over the world, some places ahead of us, some behind, but there was International Women's Year. There was that issue that people cared about. And the court, as a great legal scholar, Paul Freund, once said, should never react to the weather of the day, but inevitably it will react to the climate of the era. Mm-hmm. And the climate was right for that change. I mean, think of the 60s, think of the liberal Warren Court and the case of Hoyt against Florida. Gwendolyn Hoyt was what we would today call a battered woman, abused by her philandering husband. And one day, he had humiliated her to the breaking point. She spied a baseball bat belonging to her young son in the corner of the room. She took it and hit him over the head. He fell. It was the end of their argument. It was the end of his life, and it was the beginning of the murder prosecution of Gwendolyn Hoyt in Hillsborough County, Florida. Florida didn't put women on juries unless they came into the clerk's office and volunteered for service. How many men would volunteer if they could escape service? Her thought was, if there were women on the jury, they might better understand my state of mind. Not that they would acquit me, but at least, she thought, she might be convicted of the lesser crime of manslaughter rather than murder. She was convicted of murder by an all-male jury, and she had raised that question of the absence of women from the jury rolls in Florida all the way through the lower courts. The Supreme Court heard the case, and the attitude in 1961 was, we don't understand what women could be complaining about. They have the best of all possible worlds. They can serve if they want to. If they don't want to serve, they don't have to. Well, the notion of a citizen who escapes that basic obligation that you have to participate in the administration of justice, it really means that you don't consider that person a full citizen, that she's expendable in the administration of justice. Well, the Supreme Court didn't react as it should have to Gwendolyn Hoyt's case. 10 years later, the Berger Court writes a unanimous decision in the Sally Reed's case, saying that a provision of the Idaho probate code that said, as between persons equally entitled to administer a decedent's estate, males must be preferred to females. The court unanimously held that that was unconstitutional. It was the times, and it was that Sally Reed was an ideal representative of what women were complaining about. Her case arose in tragic circumstances. She and her husband were childless, and they adopted a boy. They then separated, and Sally was awarded custody when the boy was of tender years, needed a mother's care. When the boy reached his teen years, the father said, I want to take care of him. He needs to be prepared for a man's world. Sally thought that the father would not be a good influence on her son, and she was quite right. The boy was terribly depressed, and one day he took out one of his father's many guns and he killed himself. So Sally wanted to be appointed administrator of his estate, not because of it had any value, but for sentimental reasons. And she was faced with this provision, and she said, that's not fair. I applied first, so I should get the appointment. Now, Sally Reed was not a sophisticated woman. She made her living by taking care of elderly people in her home. She would not have called herself a feminist. She probably didn't even know the word, but she thought that she had suffered an injustice, and she had faith in the legal system that it could right that wrong.
When you're trying to use legal change to fuel social change, or in response to social change, with a feedback loop, really, how do you orchestrate the courts, the legislature, the press, the executive, to make it all happen? I imagine you thought about that in a very self-conscious way.
Well, when we started the ACLU Women's Rights Project, we had three missions. And the first was public education. People have to care about the change. The second was legislature. The legislature, get the legislature to change. That was one of the reasons why I was a big advocate of the Equal Rights Amendment, because that would prompt legislatures to clean up the law books. And then, finally, the courts. So that's, it was, we worked on all three levels. And on legislative change, we got a great gift from the dean of the law school I first attended when he was Solicitor General. This is Irwin Griswold. It came about in a tax case, and it involved a tax deduction for the care of a young child or a dependent, a disabled dependent of any age. The deduction was available to any woman or any widowed or divorced man. The plaintiff, the complainant in that case, was Charles E. Moritz, a man who never married, but took great care of his mother, though she was at the time 93. He couldn't get this deduction. He represented himself in the tax court, and his brief was the soul of simplicity. It read, "If I had been a dutiful daughter, I would get this deduction for the care of my mother. I am a dutiful son and I don't get the deduction. That makes no sense."
Those cases in the case books now are commonly referred to as the formal equality cases. And one thing I wanted to ask you is, just for the record, was your goal only formal equality?
One has to begin at the beginning. And what we faced were statute books, states and federal, that were riddled with classifications based on sex. What we wanted was to open all doors for men and for women, that nobody should be blocked from an opportunity or pursuit of a particular course in life because he was male or she was female. But many people thought that gender discrimination operated benignly in women's favor, that when women were told they couldn't do this, like couldn't work at night or couldn't work overtime because their hours were limited to 8, that all those protections sheltered women. It was hard for them to see that those so-called protections really operated, as Justice Brennan said in the Frontiero case, to put women not on a pedestal but in a cage.
That was U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg speaking to Professor Joan C. Williams at the University of California at Hastings in September 2011. You can watch or listen to her full, unedited talk at our website, radioproject.org. We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We're back at the suffrage parade in Oakland, celebrating 100 years of women being allowed to vote in the state of California. Presiding over the ceremony is Mayor Jean Kwan, the first female mayor of the city of Oakland and the first Asian American female mayor of any major American city.
Today, when people ask me, do I face more discrimination as being the first Chinese American mayor of a major American city, or as being the first woman mayor of Oakland, I often say I think being a woman is tougher at this point, that there's still a lot of stereotypes about women. People ask me, a reporter asked me at a press conference if I was tough enough, and my reaction was, do you ask guys that question? I don't think so.
Kwan's apparently in a pretty progressive city, at least by one standard. Six of Oakland's eight city council members are women, as well as the city auditor and city attorney. But, says Kwan, Oakland is far from a typical town.
We actually still have a long way to go. Of the 100 largest cities in the country, only eight of them have women mayors. And in the California legislature, it's less than 25% women. In Congress, despite very high-profile women, only 90 women serve in Congress. So it's still a long way to go. Other countries have gotten much closer to 50% than we have.
One of those countries that's arguably ahead of the U.S. in terms of women in positions of political power is Chile. With the election of Michelle Bachelet in 2006, Chile became the first in a recent wave of Latin American female presidents. While Argentina, Brazil, and Costa Rica have all followed suit, Bachelet herself has moved on. After her term expired in 2010, she was appointed executive director of the newly formed United Nations Entity for Gender Equality and the Empowerment of Women, also known as UN Women. To close out today's show, we bring you a portion of a speech Bachelet gave in April 2011 at the University of California at Berkeley.
The challenges we're facing are daunting. Women's rights in many parts of the world are not guaranteed. In many places, they are treated as second-class citizens. In some, they're not even considered citizens. In some countries of the world, women still cannot vote. Can you believe that? And the figures are clear, just to mention some of them. 60 or 70%, because I've heard different studies, of the poor of the world are women and girls. 70% of the illiterate of the world are female. 80% of the human trafficking leading to sexual slavery or labor slavery are women and girls in the world. 80 to 85% of the agricultural forces in many countries of Africa are women, but only 2% have land rights, and many do not have the right to inherit. If we talk about health, we all know what's going on. I mean, 350,000 women die every year due to pregnancy and birth complications. And also, if we see the trend of HIV/AIDS in Africa, it has the face of a woman or a girl. Rape is a common situation in conflict countries and post-conflict countries, but less than 5% of post-conflict funds are devoted to women's empowerment and gender equality. Violence against women in all its forms, domestic violence, rape, early marriage, child brides, forced marriage, female genital mutilation, or cutting, is widespread. At least 40% of the women in the world have said that they have experienced gender-based violence at least once in their lifetime. But also, if we think of the huge gaps in wealth and income that have accompanied economic growth, have deepened since the economic and financial crisis, and pushed millions of workers, especially women, into permanent informal employment. Both political conflict and natural disasters threatening livelihoods and food security in many countries and straining household coping strategies. And this does not have to be the case. I mean, this is what's happening, but we can't change that. Politicians and policymakers from all political parties can be persuaded that things can be managed better so that we can keep our country safe and our economies prospering by investing in the future, building stronger safety nets, guaranteeing basic physical and social protection for everyone. I mean, I don't want to depress you. I just wanted to share with you some of the reality of many women. But there are some progress too. We have seen progress. Over 120 countries have adopted national plans for action for gender equality, and at least 132 countries have a legislative provision to combat domestic violence. The only issue is that I believe in all the progress that we've seen in legislation, for example, the problem we have is like with the International Convention, there is a gap of implementation. In some places, because it was a commitment, but not necessarily the priority. In some places, because even government wants to do much more, they don't know how to do it. In some places, because the so-called national gender machineries, that's the ministries of women and gender affairs, are usually the most weak politically. They are under-resourced. So even if they want to do much more, they cannot do it. But on the other hand, women in countries who were once stayed out of the public arena are now standing side by side with men to demand freedom and rights and dignity and the right to participate in revitalizing their societies. But in order to do so, and not to have to wait for so more decades, we will focus in some specific area. And I really believe that the only possible way for women to have their rights respected is to women have relevance. So that's why, for me, the important issue is to empower women. And of course, empowerment in many dimensions. I mean, because social empowerment women are everywhere, you will always find women at the grassroots organization. So it's not that women are not present. They are very present, but they're not in the top position, in the decision-making position. So we don't need to empower them where they're already empowered, because they are empowered in the society. We need to empower them where we're still very far away from that. And where is that? Economic empowerment, but also because I do believe that if a woman don't have economic autonomy, it's very difficult to have rights and be sure that the rights will be effective. So we will be working on economic empowerment because we know that women, when women earn their own income, they can challenge the way decisions are made in household. They can demand the right to engage in the political arena. They can claim the right to be safe from violence. But women are still economically marginalized in many countries. In South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa, up to 80% of women workers are in some form of vulnerable employment with no benefits or security, low pay, and in many cases, no pay at all. If you look at all the informal employment, I think almost 80% are female. So we have an issue there. We have some other issues that it's not only for developing countries, it's also for developed countries. And also here is the situation of migrant workers or domestic workers. So our mandate is global. It's not only to work with developing countries, it's also to work with developed countries to improve women's conditions of labor, of life. The other second, and it's not that one is more important, they're all important, is what I would call political empowerment, or we could call it to enhance women's voices, leadership, and participation. The figures are very bad, and this is probably the worst of all the dimensions of women's progress. Only 19% of all the parliamentarians of the world are female. In this country, I believe it's 14%. And when we're talking about 19%, we're talking about Rwanda, that has the biggest one, 54%. The third is South Africa, 44%. From the 192 member states of the United Nations, right now we have only 19 female head of states or head of government, less than 10%. So it's not, it's a little bit sad, I would say. But we're not going to cry, we're going to work. So. And we know what works, because look, 15 years ago in Beijing, there was this action plan. It was defined that when you need a country to improve gender equality in terms of legislation, you know it at least a critical mass of 30% female representation in parliament. If you look 15 years after, what do we see? That in the world, 28 countries have achieved that goal. And from those 28 countries, 23 needed specific laws, I would say affirmative actions in terms to achieve that goal. So female participation, leadership, and so on is one important area. The third area that we need to work on is ending violence against women. And this is really widespread. And the difference is that we know even how much it costs. We know how many people, but also how much it costs. And it really costs a lot. So maybe some people don't care about this issue that, in my point of view, is the most pervasive violation of human rights, violence against women, but it's also very expensive for countries. The United States made a lot of studies in the past and discovered that $5.6 billion was the cost of domestic violence because of health, physical health, mental health care, and also productivity loss. In effect, that in all this conflict, rape and violence was used as a means of war. We had advanced, you know, the international justice have defined rape in conflict countries as a means of war. The same, the Security Council of the United Nations have defined that it's not only a human, it's also a security issue, but still there is little progress on that. So we will be working with the Department of Political Affairs in developing a program, a three-year program, developing critical mass of women leaders. We have the mediation skills, negotiation skills, so they can be part of the mediation team, so they can bring the voices of the women there. And I hope all of these things will be really helpful in trying to bring to these women prevention of this situation, but in case we cannot prevent it, access to justice. So we need to continue working also how we redress and reparate these women. And it's very impressive because talking to many of these women, they not necessarily want individual or material reparation. One amazing woman, she has been raped so many times, when they ask her in this audience with the High Commissioner of Human Rights about this issue, she said, "I don't want any money at all. The only reparation that I need is that you understand that my rape is not my problem. It's your problem. It's the society's problem." I think that's a wonderful attitude. I have to tell you that I'm always impressed of the strength and the capacity of those women in the most difficult circumstances, but with an incredible resilience, with an incredible spirit that they want to, you know, stand up and continue going on. And I think the challenges are enormous, but we'll work with all our energy. And with commitment and with the support of everybody, we will succeed. We are all UN women. Thank you very much.
That was former Chilean President Michelle Bachelet, who's now Undersecretary General and Executive Director of UN Women. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to the Center for Latin American Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. You can hear full-length speeches by Michelle Bachelet and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on our website, radioproject.org. Check out our website at radioproject.org to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Kyungjin Lee. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.